Beetroot juice, used by Olympic athletes for its stamina-boosting effects, caused waves at the last Olympics. Clinical studies prove 2 glasses of beetroot juice per day could increase stamina by 16%. I've been using it, and this product is excellent. Beets are a nutrition goldmine, so call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeets.com. Get a 30-day supply free. That's 800-738-2198 or intelligentbeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it is once again time for our weekly Q&A with Layla. That's a session where you get your questions answered. You can email your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, and I will work together with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin to answer your most pressing health and nutrition questions. Hi, Layla. How are you doing?
Great, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good, good. For our listening audience not familiar with this format, we answer questions. Layla Mudin is the Hoffman Center nutritionist. She's been working for over 10 years in the Hoffman Center. Hard to believe. Time flies when you're having fun.
That's right.
She's both a registered dietitian and also has earned an advanced master's degree in the field of nutrition. And just the, you know, the oppressive winter just drags on.
I've had enough.
Yeah, and a lot of people are kind of reeling under the impact of this long, cold, icy, grimy winter. And for that reason, I wrote an article this week in our newsletter. Actually, uh-huh. Came out last week, so it should be on our website, drhoffman.com. And it's about how to overcome the winter blahs. So there we have a series of tips, 10 tips that can help lighten your load this gloomy winter season. Although, you know, it's getting to the point where we can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Hopefully. Hopefully.
Yeah.
I'm tired of my hat, and I'm tired of hat head.
Exactly. Exactly. Although, you know, I have to say, though, it's kind of like, you know, the expression is, this guy's banging his head against the wall, and he asks me, why are you banging your head against the wall? And he says, well, it feels so good when I stop. And I, you know, with these temperatures, the single-digit temperatures and the wind chills below zero, on a day where it's like 21 degrees, it feels balmy here in New York.
Oh, it does. Today's in the 30s, and oh, my goodness.
30s?
Wow.
Oh, it's crazy warm. You know, it's like, you can...
It's much better than having to go to work in 5-degree weather, and with the wind chill, it's 12 below or whatever they're going on about the weather, so...
Okay. Well, you know, tip number one in my tips is don't complain. So, no, because that's not going to get us anywhere. Yeah. All right. So, before we get to our questions, in the news this week, and I posted these on Facebook, so please follow me on Facebook. We now have, let's see, how many followers do we have on Facebook? We have currently well over 2,600 followers on Facebook and growing. Astronomically,
fabulous.
Geometrically every week. And I post articles of interest on Facebook. And I also, if you're a Twitter person, I also tweet the articles. Lots of information there. And one of the articles came to my attention recently was this headline here, which is Nutritional Medicine as Mainstream in Psychiatry. Now, we've been talking about this, Layla, forever, right? I mean, many of your excellent webinars, you know, food and mood, you know, we've been doing this forever.
Yeah.
Where do you think this appeared? This appeared in the Lancet Medical Journal.
Oh, finally.
In the Lancet Psychiatry section, Nutritional Medicine is Mainstream in Psychiatry, and it's really great because the quote from that is that, and I'm quoting from the article, diet is as important to psychiatry as it is to cardiology, endocrinology, and gastroenterology.
You know, Dr. Hoffman, I went to that integrative health practitioner conference
yes.
at the New York Hilton.
Recently here in New York.
In February, just about a week ago or so. And Kelly Brogan presented all of that, and basically, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful presentation about food and mood and everything, and how she now is implementing diet much more than antidepressants and anti-anxieties.
And I know, because she's been a guest here on Intelligent Medicine, and I asked her the question. I said, do you ever find yourself resorting to medication anymore in your psychiatric practice? And I was really surprised by her answer, because I thought she said, well, you know, 90% of the time, or 95% of the time, or 98% of the time, I don't use medication. She says, I don't use medication at all anymore in my psychiatric past. So,
Bravo.
So, I mean, Kelly, I said, well, I said, what do you do when a patient comes in on medication? She says, well, I try to wean them off. You know, and she doesn't say, you know, stop on day one, but her goal is to get people to be managed without medication. So it's amazing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, by the way, I mean,
medication is toxicity. It has to poison the body in some way in order for it to do its job.
Well,
to some degree. I mean, maybe I'm being extreme in that comment.
Yeah, I'm going to dissent with you a little bit on that, because I think there are actually cases in psychiatry where people are so fried mentally that a medication can help them bridge over to a more organized lifestyle where they implement some of these natural methods. And
I
then
agree
often
with that. I mean, an acute situation deserves medicine, absolutely.
Yeah.
But not being told, here, you have to take this antidepressant or anti-anxiety for the rest of your life.
Exactly.
Get through your crisis. Get through whatever is going on. And when your life becomes more manageable, then I think is the time to wean off. Absolutely. Medical management is absolutely appropriate. I'm not anti-medicine either. But there's just been too much reliance.
You're not a Scientologist, are you, Oyden? Okay.
What's that?
I thought you and Tom were you know, hanging out in Hollywood together, Tom Cruise. No.
Oh no.
Okay, because they take a zero tolerance approach to drugs and psychiatry.
Oh no, you can't have zero tolerance for anything.
Okay.
All right. Especially in our profession. So.
Okay. So the other one that came to my attention this week. And again, you know, I find it amusing because we see this stuff in the mainstream media, and these are themes that we've been harping on for years, if not decades. Energy drinks significantly increase hyperactivity in school children. That's a big duh,
no,
isn't
kidding.
It?
You think energy causes hyperactivity?
Right. But, you know, you go down the supermarket aisles and you see, like, these energy drinks and sports drinks, and they're these crazy colors, like colors that you never see in nature, like fluorescent blue or, like, orange from, you know, like this crazy color of orange that you never see in nature. And you wonder, you know, what chemical coloring agent imparts that color? And then, of course, there's all these unmentionable ingredients and laced with caffeine and other things.
Mm.
So energy drinks significantly increase hyperactivity in school children. By how much? According to a study done in England, middle school children, you can tell the study's from England, because middle school, what does that mean? That means, like, what, junior high school?
Junior high school.
Right.
6th through 9th grade.
Yeah, okay.
6th through 8.
We're getting fancy here. We now call it middle school, too. When I was, we called it junior high school when I went to school.
Oh, I still call it junior high school.
Right. Middle school children who consume heavily sweetened energy drinks are 66% more likely to be at risk for hyperactivity and inattention symptoms. So you think, I mean, you know, you take all these energy drinks that would be like a focus factor, right? It's like taking, there's so much caffeine that you would feel extremely full. Like, what do you do if you feel like inattentive at work or something? You go out and have a Starbucks and you're more attentive? No, it's the opposite happens with these energy drinks with these kids.
It's too much, it's too much where you find yourself reading the same sentence over and over.
Yeah,
it's still not comprehending.
And the energy drinks are insidious because they, you know, parents sometimes tell kids, you know, don't drink soda. Okay, so then they have an energy drink, which somehow has the aura of something wholesome, and it will give you energy. But actually, it's you know, just a Trojan horse for all those bad ingredients.
Yeah. Well, you know what the latest trend is now, or what's upon us now, or drinks to mellow you and chill you out. I think there's one drink already that's called Chill.
Okay.
Or something like that. That will be in a grocery store near you.
Isn't that Johnny Walker Black? No, I'm just kidding. That's already out there.
You know, so if you've had an energy drink, go get something to,
There are whole stores that sell these types of drinks. They're called liquor stores.
Oh, okay. Boy. Yeah.
That's America's traditional chill beverage. All right. And then this one, this is from an English paper, The Telegraph, which is one of the tabloids in England. You know, it's not exactly the the Times of London or The Guardian. Headline, fluoride in drinking water may trigger depression and weight gain, warn scientists. Now, okay, so I'm thinking like, what is it about fluoride that does that? Well, take a guess.
It interferes with iodine.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah.
You didn't see the article, but you got it right away. There's several things that interfere with iodine. They are chlorine, bromine, and fluoride. And we get bromine in a lot of baked goods. It's used
in bread.
And chlorine, of course, you know, our water is chlorinated.
Yes.
Right?
And then showers you take and all that, sure.
And fluoride is, you know, the water's fluoridated. So you get all these chemicals, and they interfere, they actually block the uptake of iodine by your thyroid. And thus, they can trigger hypothyroid, which the Telegraph headline doesn't say fluoride causes hypothyroidism. They say it may trigger depression and weight gain. Well, those are cardinal symptoms of hypothyroidism.
Yeah.
So there you go. All right. So,
not to mention that all that fluoride may brittle our bones.
Exactly. And did we see any of these stories coming? Oh, yeah. Big time.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take some questions.
Okay. Our first question comes from Carol. Actually, it's not a question. She's asking, would you please talk about pycnogenol in depth? This is a wonderful and powerful antioxidant.
Right.
Well, actually, you know, in looking on our website at the actual description, we know that it's a super antioxidant. It can support circulatory health, joint function, and it's actually made. It's a plant extract derived from the bark of the French maritime pine tree.
Right.
So,
and now, by the way,
France.
Have you ever seen a French maritime pine tree? Have you been to France?
I wouldn't be able to point it out.
Okay. Have you been to France? Or
no, I haven't.
Oh, okay. Because I was recently, it's actually many years ago, I went to Nice to watch someone do a triathlon. It was the Ironman Triathlon of Nice, which was an amazing event.
Wow.
And so in Nice, I saw these gnarly pine trees. They're very gnarly. They almost look like bonsai bushes because they're small. Not miniature, but they're, you know, like 3 or 4 feet tall. And they're very gnarly. And the wind there is very, very strong. And the sun is very, very strong. And so these trees are really an example of resilience in the face of very challenging conditions, high winds and extremes of temperature. And they grow on hillsides. And those are Pinus maritimus, or maritime pine trees of the south of France, and they the bark of those trees gives you pycnogenol, and so there's actually a principle in plant physiology, which is the more stress a plant undergoes, the more likely it is to elaborate beneficial substances, and they're called phytoalexins, which are resistance substances, probably with antioxidant activity, that help defend off the rays of the sun or, you know, ultraviolet and various forms of insect stress, fungal invasion, yada, yada, yada. And it's actually a principle in winemaking that wine grown in the most optimal, perfect circumstances, you know, sort of a bland environment that doesn't change very much, this wine is not as good or tasty as the wine that is grown with a little stress. You know, there's like a cold snap, or there's like a, you know, like a little bit of a dry spell, heat wave. That makes the grapes taste better. And the taste comes from these natural compounds. For example, resveratrol is a phytoalexin, and pycnogenol is a phytoalexin, which comes from, you know, the plant's resistance to stress. Anyway.
Wonderful.
So
adversity makes it stronger.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And in many, you know, as in life, plant physiology, and from the standpoint of, and that's another reason why, you know, all these GMO products and highly pesticide treated products, they're just not as nutritious as products that have had to cope with environmental stress on their own.
You know, that's an excellent point. That's that's something else we have to consider with GMO.
So like almost like the hygiene hypothesis for plants is like humans that, you know, look, diseases used to take a terrible toll before vaccines and antibiotics, but people were tougher and more resilient.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So pycnogenol is actually one of the best researched of all the natural products, because the company that makes it, it's a closely held company. There's a guy named Dr. Masquelier who discovered this stuff, I don't know, back in the 50s or 60s. And they have actually reinvested a lot of the proceeds from selling pycnogenol into good research. So have you looked at some of the research on benefits of pycnogenol?
Not lately,
okay.
Actually.
Okay,
there are many.
Yeah. Yeah, well, pycnogenol has been shown to increase walking distance and claudication, so it has helpful effects on circulation in economy class syndrome, which is, you know, you go for these long flights. Recently, you know, they had this episode of a basketball player who developed a pulmonary embolus, and basketball players travel a lot on planes. They're big, tall guys and get squenched into sometimes seats that are too small, and you can develop a blood clot in your leg. Pycnogenol actually helps, it's been shown in studies, to reduce the tendency for blood clots to form. So we use it for that. We use it for brain. There's some studies on attention and on dementia with pycnogenol. So there's quite a lot of research on pycnogenol.
Yeah, yeah. So, and pycnogenol also provides nutrients that are found in some foods like apple skins, lemon rind, potato. But, you know, not everybody's going to consume lemon rind, which can be a little unpleasant, but yeah, lots of benefits overall.
So it's good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we use it. We use it for patients with neurological disorders. We use it for patients with circulatory disorders, for cardiovascular prevention. And I personally take it. I take it as a daily preventive supplement. So I think that I have to say one other thing that I recall. I'm just doing this off the top of my head. I'm not looking it up. But if you look it up, you'll see people ask us, you know, what are the benefits? I mean, you can actually you can Google pycnogenol. You'll see all kinds of studies. But one study that sticks out in my mind is a study done on knee pain with pycnogenol. Mm-hmm. There was a significantly greater improvement in knee pain with pycnogenol than with placebo. So there's something about that, too.
Yeah, it protects cartilage. Oh, that's a good thing. All right. Karen, thank you for your question. All right. You should use some pycnogenol. Everybody should.
Yep.
Our next question's from Larry. We've had a similar question in the past. Larry is trying to avoid cataract surgery. Is there any other way to treat the cataracts, or is surgery really it? Larry is 66 and otherwise healthy. I think the time to is prevention.
Right.
You want to keep the cataracts from forming.
Or if you have early, a lot of people have been told, well, you have early cataracts, but we're going to wait because it doesn't pay to do the surgery. You have to wait until they so-called ripen. In other words, to get to the point where you really, really need to do an operation. Because if you did cataract surgery on everyone with mild cataracts, you know, people would get them at too young an age unnecessarily.
Yeah. Well, I know that vitamin C is helpful as an antioxidant. It can actually, I think it has to do with the lens of the eye. I think it keeps it from becoming stiff.
Yeah.
So, tell you, Dr. Hoffman, I take a lot of supplements, not as many as you do.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, I'll run out of something and I don't replace it right away, with the exception of my vitamin C.
Yeah, you really are very careful.
And that's been for decades.
Yeah.
I'm just a huge vitamin C fan. So, yeah.
So, it is proposed cataracts that carnosine eye drops, carnosine eye drops, help to reverse cataracts. But I have to say that the studies on that are rather small and weak. And I also find it a little bit unpersuasive, because I liken the development of cataracts to what happens when you make a sunny side up in an egg pan. Got a cast iron egg pan. I really love it. It has to be properly seasoned with oil. You do it. It's kind of like a blacksmith kind of procedure, and you make it really nonstick, and then you don't get any chemicals. You just may just get a little extra iron. But I make my eggs in a pan. When I throw that transparent egg white into the pan and it cooks, it becomes opacified and white. And that's a fast forward or fast motion study of what happens in your eye over a period of years is that the clear material in your lens opacifies, and heat at very high temperatures would speed up that process. You know, just like when you, you know, if you threw a, you know, dissected an eye and threw a lens in a hot pan, it would turn opaque pretty quickly. But over, but it's hard to imagine how you can reverse that. It's kind of like, how do you unscramble an egg?
Right.
How do you,
right.
So I'm really not sure that there's some magic formula for dissolving that cross-linking. It's actually cross-linking of collagen. And once collagen is cross-linked, it's very hard to uncross-link. It's sort of like, well, how do you make wrinkles disappear? Well, to some extent, you can smooth the skin, or you can use Botox, you can use fillers. But really, wrinkles are an example of irreversible cross-linking of the collagen. And collagen is a structure that underlies many parts of the body, including, you know, the bones, the joints, but also the lens of the eye. And it's really hard to imagine how you can uncross-link it once the cross-links have occurred.
Do you think wearing sunglasses is beneficial?
Big time. Big time. There's no question. No question. Yep. That's the ultraviolet.
The radiation.
Absolutely. You can get cataracts from like a single bout of, if you're watching a solar eclipse and you don't properly protect your eyes. And actually, for some of the same reasons, it appears that you can slow the progression of cataracts possibly with some of the macular degeneration formulas, the things that have lutein and zeaxanthin. Those are more targeted to the retina of the eye, but they seem to possibly have some benefits for
maybe bilberry.
The front of the eye. Yeah, you know, those, they're potent antioxidants. Having plenty of those in the diet, I think, helps. I really think a study should be done looking at the dietary antecedents of people who get early cataracts.
Yeah.
It's probably partially genetic. It's partially, you know, that they don't wear sun protective gear. But it'd be interesting to see, do they eat lots of fruits and vegetables? Do they drink tea? Do they have spices in their diet? Do they take supplemental vitamins? And, you know, a study like that should be undertaken, because we've done that kind of study with cancer, with heart disease. Studies like that are hard to do because they involve thousands and thousands of people trying to recall their diet over decades. But it would be interesting to see if there's a dietary component. Maybe such a study exists, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah. Okay, Larry, thank you for your question.
All right. This is a good point at which to pause, because we divide these podcasts into two parts. So let's stipulate this part one of today's Q&A with Layla. And Layla, give us a preview of what we're going to see in part two.
Multiple myeloma and bone mineral density.
Okay. So be it. So please stay with us. Go to part two of today's Q&A with Layla, and we'll continue with your questions. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.